what you saw on the screen when you first walked in is like the card that you have there in your seat. If you go to NAM.net, you can find Love Loud, and you can find our resources that we're trying. Y'all, slide down a little bit, man. That's too close to me, man. Come on, Tyrone. No, really, move it on down some. We're going to move. There you go. We like each other and all that, but that's, you know, that was a joke. Nobody's laughing yet. I feel like Louie last night. Come on, y'all are there, right? If you go to NAM.net, you'll be able to find the way we've tried to organize this ministry. If you look at the little card that you have there, because there's so many opportunities to align compassion and mercy ministries with missional living, we've tried to put it together in those three categories. Now, a logical question is, what's the difference in a neighbor and a community? The neighbor is trying to deal with individual needs. Communities where they're collectively living, and you realize that you've got to have a different approach to community transformation. I can tell you, I know enough about these three men that they don't pretend to know it all, and they would not want to be called experts, but they are practitioners that have gotten out of the gate, and they have a story to tell about how God has been working in their lives and in their churches. I would love to tell you a little bit of my story, but I want these three men to tell you theirs. And Jerry's going to see if we can figure out how to turn this projector off so we don't have a spotlight. There we go. Still a little bit there, Jerry. I went a little over about 10 years ago, 10 and a half years ago, to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, to pastor a church that had an incredible reputation of being a Bible-believing, evangelistic church involved in a lot in overseas ministries. And I felt like probably the role that we would be playing is that in that church, we would be finding a way to help a lot of other churches get involved internationally. And that, in fact, did happen. But I was a little shocked when one of our associate pastors was speaking to the local newspaper about what was going on at Calvary and giving the rundown of what we were going to be doing that summer. And he started talking about the international trips that were going to be going on, and he started talking about, he said, one of the coolest things is our teenagers are going to be involved in this thing called World Changers, and they're going to be going to such and such a city. They're going to be on roofs repairing widows' homes, and started telling that story. And when he finished, the local newspaper editor said, if Calvary ever does that in Winston-Salem, it'll be news. And when he came back and told me that, I just hung my head. And I said, our city doesn't believe we love them. They think we're in this for us. They really don't understand, and we're not effectively doing what we need to be doing to love our city. So we set out on a journey that we called Love Winston-Salem. Started another campus in Davie County, so it had to be Love Davie, and it got pretty complicated. It was all over. But we set out on a journey to see if we could figure out how to love our city. And God used it in an incredible way to take a already mobilized church for international missions and help us see in our city what Jesus sees. And it's not perfect. It's still growing, still learning. But it was in that context that I began to see what I've come to call God's heart for our neglected neighbors. I'd seen God's heart for the nations, at least a glimpse. I tried to show the thread throughout Scripture, but I had failed to see God's heart for the neglected neighbor and see how he continuously says that he is the God of the widow, the orphan, the foreigner among you, and the poor. And so I believe that if you're a church leader, that you want to find ways to help your church see that. It comes through your preaching. It comes through the look in your eye. It comes through your personal passion. But there are practical things that you can do to help your church experience this. And that's why I've invited these men today. Craig is here at First Baptist Woodstock. And he has been willing to agree that it's okay that we stole the name Love Loud, and that that's what we're using at the North American Mission Board. Tyrone is pastoring here in the city, and he's got a story to tell of how God has worked in that. I promised Craig that I'll make sure he gets to go first, and that we release him a little early, because he's in charge of making sure we can figure out how to have lunch. It's part of his responsibility on staff here. And don't you appreciate how First Baptist has been hosting us and what they've done? So if there are any seats around you, we've got some folks coming in. I know that you don't like to move if you've already got an aisle seat, but just be careful, and if you can slide in or wave at somebody in the back and let them know you got a seat beside them, and we'll have a little close fellowship. So let's start with you, Craig. Well, no, let's start with prayer. Would you pray with me? All right? Father, we do pray that you would lead our time. I know that these are men and women who have a heart to see your people on mission with you. So, Lord, I pray now that you'd give us insight as we share, and that you'd help us to learn from one another. And that's our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. I know that most of you will learn just by hearing a story. I will cross-examine these guys a little bit to see if they can give us some more specific things to help you, because we want to be fair to the title we gave you, that you what you thought you were coming to, all right? But, Craig, I'm going to start with you. How did Love Loud start here at First Baptist Woodstock?
Well, first of all, thank you for coming. Thank you for coming to this event. We're very excited about hosting it. Love Loud began in 2008 with Pastor Johnny from the pulpit shared that he wanted to do two things. One was begin a foster care ministry, which we did at that time, and God has really, really blessed that. We've enjoyed foster children in the homes of First Baptist Woodstock that amount to over 50 years of time that children have been in there. We've had as many as 30 foster children in homes of First Baptist Woodstock, and had 12 adoptions, one just recently through that ministry. That same night, Pastor Johnny said he wanted to do a mission trip to our town, to our community. And I love missions. As I was sharing, most of my mission work had been in foreign missions. And so I emailed Pastor Johnny the next day and said I would be interested in being a part of that. And shortly thereafter, I was in charge of both the foster care ministry and Love Loud. So we began to, the creative services team here began to put their thoughts together on what this should be all about. And we decided to our target would be the widow, the single mom, the orphan, and the impoverished. So we put our... We put our plan together based on that target, okay? So the orphan, the widow, the single mom, and the impoverished in our community, which is really kind of hard to define here because this is one big melting pot of communities, but typically within a 10 to 15-mile radius. And so Love Loud came about just through... brainstorming. The name Love Loud came about just through brainstorming, and that is we want to love our community loudly. Well, actions speak louder than words, and so we began putting together the strategy to touch this community. This year, every year in October is our Love Loud. We go 3 days. We call it our 3-day mission trip to our community. And we will have over 150 projects. And on the Saturday of Love Loud, it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, we'll have about 2,500 people at various projects. One of those 150 projects, anywhere from a class of five doing a project for a widow to 200 people that are ministering to the Hispanic community right in Canton, north of us, okay? So we run Love Loud through our Sunday school. We have a very strong Sunday school here at First Baptist Woodstock. So our first meetings are always with the Sunday school teachers and their Love Loud delegates, their Love Loud champion in their class. And we ask them, beginning in May, to begin praying for the opportunity that their class will embrace. And most of our projects are centered around a Sunday school class. doing a project that God has brought on their heart, which raises the energy level for supporting that opportunity. Okay? I got you. Inside joke. We don't call them projects, or I try not to call them project. I do call them opportunities, okay? And so Al's corrected me on that. And then we do have at-large opportunities as well, okay? So we feel like Love Loud is an opportunity for the uninvolved, the people that are not involved in Sunday school, which here is about 20% of the 6,500 people that will be in service. 20% of those, Alan Tay will get on to me for that number. 10 to 20% of those people are not in Sunday school on a Sunday morning. So the at-large opportunities are for those Sunday, for those people, the unengaged, that we try to engage them through this Touch Your Community project. Okay, so we do have at-large opportunities as well.
Let's let everybody just kind of get on the table how they got in this game. Okay, so Tyrone, we'll move to you. I just want you to know, I want to say publicly how much respect I have for you as a man of God in this city, in Atlanta, how God's using you and your heart to help and serve others, not just in your own congregation. So tell us a story about how God launched this in your congregation.
Well, I started the church 19 years ago here in Atlanta. I wanted to preach and see life change, and there's no greater way to do that than to look what God brings into our congregation. We started with feeding programs. We started looking at the young people in our community who were at risk. Went to the judges and parole officers to find out how can we as a church help. And we began mentoring programs. Judges would mandate kids to our program. We were, at this time, just to let you know, you don't have to be a church. We've got thousands of people in our congregation today, 1,500 that attend on Sunday morning. But at that time, 50, 60 people were coming to our church. And we started many of the ministries that are still going today with 50, 60, 70 people in attendance. And they would mandate these kids to us. We fed our community. We did all those different things. That's how we got involved. And the Lord's just really, really blessed in a mighty way. We were sharing earlier before we started today about, you know, what is God doing? God will bring opportunities to your church. We started our domestic violence ministry and our street grace ministry that deals with prostitution and human trafficking. Atlanta is the number one city in America for human trafficking, number one city for slave trade, sex slave trade in all of America. And all that came about in our own church service where I was preaching on a Bible study and a young lady said, Pastor, I'm hearing you talk this at the end of the service. She says, I heard you hear you talk about holiness and righteousness and all this, but I'm going to a stripper pole tonight and because I have nothing else, no other options. And so I stood up and I said, young lady, how much is your rent? And she told us how much it was. I said, my wife and I will take care of your rent for the next 2 months. And I said, somebody else, how much is your light bill? How much is your gas bill? We had individuals begin to get her off of the streets right then. And that started our street grace ministry, our domestic violence ministry of helping young girls and women who are in that terrible, terrible industry. All types of different things. We went to our schools. We think the greatest area of need is our public school system. Instead of just starting a Christian school, we wanted to be able to reach the public schools. So we went to all the principals and said, we want to be involved in your school. What can we do to be able to help? And so now when they have gang problems, they have other issues, they give us open assemblies in four of the high schools in Atlanta to do a whole gospel presentation. One whole hour, myself and my youth pastor will come and they'll empty the whole school in the gym or the auditorium and we'll get a chance to share the gospel with them in a wonderful and powerful way. That led to us getting a grant to have an after-school care ministry where we ministered to 140 kids whose families are just hurting in mighty ways. I could just go on and on with all those ministries. We started transitional housing. We didn't have houses and things like we have now. It's a dilapidated house that was right next to our church. We got some men to fix it up, and it was just, I'm telling you, just strike a match in it, it'll burn up. I prayed every night, God, please don't let, you know, this thing, but we started that home, and that became David's Den, a place where broken men from jail and drug programs could get help. And we just started that ministry right there without any money and without any resources, just the money within our own congregation, our own church. And then that led to those men didn't have jobs, they didn't have resources. And so we started a ministry called RAW, Recovery at Work. And we got master carpenters and master painters and master masons to work alongside these men so that they could get employed. And then we would go get contracts for building a basement or to fix a deck or to paint someone's house. And then we employed these guys. And then the contractors would hire the guys who used to be ex-felons because they couldn't get jobs. And it's amazing what took place in that regard. And we've got even up to the biggest contract we got was a $250,000 contract to do a fence around an apartment complex. And with those resources, we were able to house those men and continue to help them and get them back into the community. One of them died about 2.5 weeks ago. One of the men that we ministered to, he passed away about two and a half weeks ago in Detroit, when he went to go see his mom, who had been estranged from for over 20 years. And he'd gotten miraculously saved in our congregation, in our church. We knew that, but he was still struggling with Muslim. He was a Muslim, and he was back and forth between those two areas, and we just knew that God had his hand on his life. But he went there, and he died, and I was really just concerned because I didn't really get a full testimony to give his life to Christ. Well, his mother called me. I wasn't able to go to the funeral in Detroit, and she said, "I want you to know how he died." She said, "We found him in his bedroom on the floor, and the Bible was open to the gospel, and in the trash can was the little thing that the kofi. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm terrible with that. It was in the trash can, and his Quran was in the trash can, and his Bible was open. And it's amazing that God did a mighty work. And that's the work. That's what happens. A lot of people that we minister to, we don't see those stories. You minister and to 100 people, and maybe 80 of them, you don't hear those wonderful stories. But that 20%. Those 20 individuals are really is what it's all about. And that's what I got into this ministry for, to do that. And we're just excited about all the Lord is doing. But so many other things I could talk about, but I'll save it for some other.
I think we'd like to hear them, don't you? Huh? Amen. Well, Jerry, you have an entirely different kind of setting that you're in. So tell them where you're serving and a little bit about how they started with you.
I'm serving with Grove Avenue Baptist Church in Richmond, Virginia. We're a very suburban church, and I joined the staff about 5.5 years ago, and we began to do some strategic planning. And one of the first questions I asked the pastor, we have an historic live worship broadcast that, 25,000 households every Sunday are watching. I asked our pastor, if Grove Avenue Baptist Church went away tomorrow, what would the city of Richmond miss? And he thought for a minute. He said, "I have an answer, but I don't like it." He said, "I think they might miss our television broadcast, but I think that's all." And that was what he said. And I said, "We need to change that." And so as a staff, we began to pray about how could we touch our community in such a way that they knew we loved them. The church historically was known for a conservative Bible preaching pulpit. If you wanted to hear the Bible preached, if you wanted to come and study the Bible, Grove Avenue was known as a conservative pulpit. It was not known as a place of grace. In fact, many of people in the city considered the church to be judgmental or to be arrogant. And we said, that's not how people perceive Jesus. The scripture says he was full of grace and full of truth. And so we begin to try to raise our great grace quotient. And so as a staff, we begin to pray, what do we do? How do we begin to touch our community? And as a staff, we said, the first place that community really appears is in the public school system. And so we begin to pray, how could we partner with our public schools? And Richmond's a pretty liberal place, and therefore the idea of churches and public schools, people said, "I don't think you can do that." I said, "I think we can. We need to pray." And we prayed that God would show us which public school principal to approach. And after praying for about 2 months, our children's minister came to us and said, "There's a principal at one of our local public schools that I think would be willing to partner with us." So I went and sat down with him, and I said, "Rob, this is what we're trying to do. We understand the protocol. We understand we need to respect all sorts of things, but would you be willing for us to partner with you?" First thing he let me know was that he was a believer. He also let me know that he had plenty of tenure and he was willing to risk a little bit. And so the church had hosted an annual kind of Halloween fall festival on the church property for many years. That was a real big deal. But what I discovered is that almost nobody came to that except church people. And so I said, "Rob, would you be willing to host a fall festival? We'll put it on your school grounds. We'll provide all the volunteers. We want to bless your community and get to know who lives around your school. And he agreed to that. God allowed us to turn out about 150 volunteers to host the festival. The PTA was thrilled because it was too early in the school year. They never could get a fall festival together. And so we turned out 150 volunteers. We were sharing in staff meeting about how wonderful the event had gone. The children's minister came to me later in the day and said, while we were on in staff meeting, another public school principal called and left a message on my answering machine and asked if we would be willing to help them with an international festival. This particular school has 27 languages spoken in the homes of the children that go to that school. They do an international festival in February, but had a hard time getting volunteers. Well, our church happens to be the church that many of the leaders of the International Mission Board attend, and we happen to have members who speak languages from all over the world. And so in February, we hosted an international festival at that other public school, and every room that parents came in that night, they were greeted in their native language by people who could speak to them. Then we get a call from another elementary school. So we've got suburban elementary schools calling and asking us to partner. But I said, that's not good enough. The city of Richmond schools inside the city are some of the worst schools in the country. And so the next year, we decided to host our festival in a neighborhood that many of our members said, is it safe to go down there to have that festival in that neighborhood? And I said, between 10 and 2 on Saturday afternoon, I think you're okay. Out of that festival, we became the PTA for that public school. We and another church in the neighborhood, we partnered with them. We provided PTA room moms for every classroom in this elementary school where the parents were not involved at all. We began tutoring students there. Another thing that God opened for us, there's an immigrant population of Bhutanese refugees. And we have a group of about 10 or 12 ladies and a couple of men, actually, who are going into the homes every week of these refugees teaching English to them. We have recently seen 9 of these folks convert from Hinduism to Christianity. I called on one of my International Mission Board friends who had served in Nepal. I said, I want you to go visit with these people. I want to make sure that they really have come to know Christ. I don't want us to delude ourselves. They visited with them. They said, these are genuine professions of faith of people who have been loved. In our ESL classes, they would read every part of the lesson. They would read a piece of the Bible in English and read a piece of the Bible in Nepali. They even had the Hindu pundit, who was one of the leaders, would actually read the Nepali Bible. And so God just opened doors there. There are many other ways. We started very small. We begin to pray, where would God give us an opening? We now are partnering with about 12 public schools all over the city of Richmond. In a recent meeting where the local school board was recognizing the importance of faith-based involvement, I didn't even want to go to the – it was one more thing on my calendar I didn't want to go. I showed up and I discovered the whole program was the school board recognizing the work of Grove Avenue Baptist Church. And a school principal who stood and talked about how one of our Sunday school classes had adopted their school, and anything she needed, she knew she could call these people, and they loved them and cared about them. So it's a real blessing just to get outside the walls. Our pastor talks about it a lot now. It's a theme in our worship services regularly, and we have people beginning to imagine, what could I go do to help someone in need?
Perhaps you're hearing a theme that relates to the schools would be a great place for you to start, to go and see what Jesus sees and how your church might serve. In Winston-Salem, when we found ourselves trying to look for ministry opportunities, we went to the Kimberly Park School. And if you come to Winston-Salem tomorrow and ask one of the pastors there to take you on a little tour, they would show you that we have a section of town that is primarily black. We have another section of town that's primarily Latino. And it would be a neglected neighborhood and not just neglected neighbors, a neglected community and not just neglected neighbors. I remember my wife and I going in to talk to the principal, Dr. Baker, a lady who was taking over the Kimberly Park School. And it was kind of fun. She looked at my wife, KK. She said, Now, do I call you Pastor KK? She said, no, ma'am, we don't do that in our church. And she said, well, I can't call you KK. So she called her Lady KK. And Amber said to Lady KK, the devil's had these kids long enough, and I'm tired of it. And we're going to find a way to love them and lead them to Jesus. And when Calvary said, we want to help, she said, could you be the PTA? Same thing. We don't have parents. So our teachers don't have any support. And gave us just, we can do anything we want serving that school as we were able to serve as their PTA. Happened across town in the Latino school. Didn't find a Christian principal. But by the way, we served the school. They started telling the people right around the corner, Calvary has a campus, and the pastor there speaks Spanish, and they're willing to help you. And that's where Magdalena's story came from, when she said one night, we started bringing our children because, she said this through an IMB retired missionary translating her Spanish, we started bringing our children because I don't speak English, and I could not help my children with their homework. Listen now. They're probably in your community. I couldn't help them with their homework because I don't speak English. Started bringing my children because I knew you were Christian people and we could trust you. Started bringing my children because we could not feed them every day. None of our rich folks knew that we had families in town that couldn't feed them every day. We couldn't see our neglected neighbors. Started bringing my children, and you started telling me about Jesus, and I gave my heart to Jesus. That's why I want to be baptized tonight. Magdalena's story. When God starts showing you a person of peace like Dr. Amber Baker, or starts showing you a place where you can serve just one person and start helping, you'll be amazed at how he starts then opening roads to uniquely. It'll be different in your community if you haven't started. But it will come by invitation from heaven. And when you start seeing what Jesus sees, and he gives you that opportunity. One of the things that we've discovered about mobilization is it's a process of awakening, moving and growing, and strategic alignment. Awakening is that opportunity like a mission trip that you take, Craig. The moving and growing is when you start learning how to really help, not just make yourself feel better. Come on now, that'll be an amen. You get that, right? Sometimes we do it just to make us feel better. But it's not just to make us feel better, but how we can really help. And then strategic alignment, how that we can use everything that God's given to the people of God to be a blessing to the peoples of the world. Now, Craig, I'm going to see if we can let you answer one more question and then maybe field a question and let you go, all right? But what I'd like to get you to address, because every church is different, your ongoing ministries and then this mission trip that you take with these opportunities, just speak a little bit about how they feed and relate to each other.
Well, we do quite a bit of community ministry 24/7, 365. We have a job bank, which if you go around the hallways, you'll see different job postings. And even in the B building, we have an office manned with three personnel that strictly help people find jobs. Downstairs in our B building, I believe it's open today, we have a thrift store, which all of the funding for the thrift store goes towards giving clothing to the people that have needs in our community. It's very impressive, a thrift store on the bottom floor of the B building. And down there also, we have our benevolence ministries, where if people need bills to pay and so forth like that, we'll help them there, as well as financial counseling and a food bank, food ministry downstairs. It's our care ministries in the bottom of B building. So very blessed by the way that our church does serve the community 24/7, 365. And these 3 days in October, this year it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, last week in October, is when we intentionally ask our people to go on mission to their community. And the reason we phrase it that way is because we want it to be that first baby step that a lot of our people will take into their mission field right here that might very well lead to international missions, but also we've had dozens of ministries birthed in October as a result of people diving into the needs of our community and sticking. And that's what we're challenging our people, serve and stay. So they will serve those 3 days. And we've got dozens of people on boards of ministries, hundreds of people that go into neighborhoods all around our community here, and there are some in great need of ministry right here within 5 miles of this church who are going each and every week doing bread ministry, doing tutoring. Just put a trailer in one of the trailer parks here where we're there, you know, 24/7, 365, and the kids come there after church and so on and so forth. So we've supplemented in a big way our regular care ministries with these 3 days, and those 3 days have worked to expand our ongoing ministry to our community here. They serve, they fall in love with it, they fall in love with the people that they're serving, and they just don't leave. They keep it up. That's a great question. The question is, first of all, one of the ways that we got buy-in from our church in year one, and that will happen this Sunday, is we, in our bulletin and on our website, will allow the people of our church to submit possibilities, to submit opportunities. So we are asking our entire church, hey, we know that there's needs right around you. Please submit those needs to us, and we'll turn them into Love Loud opportunities. Many of the Sunday school classes are like, we just can't come up with an opportunity, Craig. We need your help. And we use these that come in from our church to give to these Sunday school classes or make them at large projects so they can chase them down and serve those opportunities. And what it did is it made our church say, wow, they're interested in what we are interested in and how we desire to serve as those possibilities turned into real opportunities. So we have some. In fact, my daughter submitted one unbeknownst to me that said, you know, my family needs a finished basement, okay? So, you know, we have needs like that. I want to buy a new car for somebody. Love Loud is about opportunities. It's about opportunities for everybody to serve. So a Love Loud opportunity is not buying somebody a car. We do have a car ministry, and we do turn cars around to people that need it. But Love Loud is about our people serving. So the things that we look at, and we have what we call ingredients to a Love Loud opportunity. It's a list of about 10 things, and they have to have high involvement. Okay, high involvement. They have to be local. They have to be an opportunity for a widow, a single mom. They have to be for a non-church member. Now, we have tons of ways we serve the people with needs in our church, tons of ways. But Love Loud is about serving others, and it can very quickly turn into serving ourselves. So we work real hard at that, okay? So community, high involvement, the targeted, we want to target those that God has laid on our heart, and we want them to be people outside of our church. And there's a few others, but those are the ones. And we actually have teams that analyze every opportunity to make sure that we check off the boxes of what a Love Loud opportunity looks like to make sure that it fits.
So would that actually be on your website, some of those criteria, or not? Okay. Well, one of the things that we would like to do to serve you is to find best practices like this, find ways to get that body of knowledge transferable so you can use it. And we don't feel like we're supposed to have the experts in Alpharetta. We feel like God's called us to be air traffic control, you know, just to try to make sure we get these planes that are there to show people how to land and get to the gate. And so we want to do what we can to help in that. And I hope we're starting a big conversation in this room today, and we'll do what we can to work with Craig to either route people there or to get that back to our site. Okay? Send them to me. You can.
Okay. Two things. One is there are churches all around that are doing Love Louds in their churches. And so some very small churches and some larger churches. And with Al's help, we would be more than happy to provide any information we can. And then my school story, and then I'll leave and get Chick-fil-A ready for you guys, is what we support the schools around here, and we actually are very blessed in that we have a great relationship with our schools. All of the high school graduations so far are held at our church, all five of them in this local community. So we've got a great rapport, okay? But we started out just being able to do mulch and landscaping projects at our schools, okay? But as we did that, and as we invested in those schools, and as our people showed up and gave of their time, it opened doors in a great way in our schools, where that many of our schools now don't say, come mulch. They say, we've got 10 families that really need your help, and here's their names and numbers, and they've already been vetted for you. They're waiting. And that is an A-plus project for us. It's when we're able to go into a home and serve a family face-to-face and build that relationship. So thank you very much. Thank you, Al.
Well, thank you, Craig. Thanks, Lonnie. When I first made this transition last September, a layman from Bellevue came running up to me at an executive committee meeting in Nashville. He's a personal friend. And he said, okay, Al, tell me what you're doing. So I started describing it to him. He said, have you heard the Bellevue story? I said, no, I don't think I have. Tell me the Bellevue story. Any of you heard the Bellevue story? Bellevue loves Memphis? They had this burden on their heart, and they just started figuring out how they could serve their city and not just be known as Fort God out there on the end when you come driving in and you see it. That's what the truckers call it, I've been told, as they come driving into Memphis. And as he started telling me this story, he said, our pastor just recently was invited to a very large African-American convention that was taking place in Memphis. And they introduced him as a man who was having some of the greatest influence in serving Memphis because of how we've been serving the schools and what we've been doing. And he was the first white man to get this award of community service at this particular convention. I think that's pretty cool, that the love was heard, that they could see that it was real. And now, just in case you're interested, I haven't checked their website lately, but I know that I visited with the people there at Bellevue, and they don't take a mission trip to their city. They break it down into quarters. And so they do it for a couple of days, one quarter, and a couple of days, another quarter, and they list just dozens of opportunities for their people to get involved. And yes, okay, and in addition to that, one of the things that they've started doing is finding ways that they can serve other churches because they recognize their stewardship, that they can serve other churches. And they have bought a dental bus. Some of your state conventions, North Carolina had a couple of them, and we used them at Calvary. But they've bought a dental bus that they're using there in Memphis. And they're going to the churches that are there in the greater Memphis area, teaching them how to host a dental clinic, teaching them how to set up the appointments, how to do the interviews. And this is the cool part about it. They begged them to take the credit for it and not give the credit back to Bellevue. You need to really grasp how kingdom projects work. If you go into this to market your church and take the credit for it, the hand of God will not be on it. But if you go into this to say, what can we do to serve and do our best to get people to notice Jesus in the process, and then whether or not they come to our church house is not the point, but we're doing what we can to serve people and lead them to Christ and maybe even help churches in these communities where we're going to serve because they're not going to come cross town. They weren't going to come cross town to our church house. And so we had to find churches in these communities we were trying to serve and figure out how to partner with them. Are you tracking with me? So I want to make sure you get that. Now, Tyrone, as I asked you a moment ago about how to get started, one of the things you told me is you said, well, we need to see that there's some things already going on in our church family that might teach us. So just come back and address that one more time.
Looking at the needs of the people in our own congregations, we can't be under the illusion that everybody is well. Every family is whole. And so oftentimes God gives us a clue of what he wants us to do by who's already in the house and providing an opportunity for them to be able to be safe, to share their own pain, and then provide ways in which to minister to them, because we found that the best people to be able to do the ministry outside of the church are the people in the church who were helped, and now they are now able to give back. And I think most of the ministers we have actually come from individuals in our church who were helped, and now they want to help and serve. But then not just there, looking within our the visitors that attend, following them home. I know we do the phone calls and the telephone and those things, but find out when you go home, find out what's really going on there, and that's a clue often to what God wants to have done in the community itself. And so that's real big for us as well. Just watching the news, what we'll do is we'll have a house fire take place in our community, maybe 5, 6, 7 miles away. And then we'll have a team to go and to minister to that family who was burned out. Something's going on in a high school. The high school quarterback was killed in a car accident. Go and minister to that family and to those kids. Bring them into the church. Have some kind of ministry. You're not trying to exploit that situation, but you're trying to cover the pain. And the pain in the community is a great opportunity that I believe God raises up for us to be able to address, because he wants to get into the lives of those families and those individuals. So things like that are going on in the community. You want to bring them into the church or the church out to where they are. Those things are very, very important as we go. What he said is the individuals that we minister to, it's great. They want to take, they'll come to the food. We fed 1,500 people last month in food. They'll do that, but they won't necessarily attend the church or the recovery ministries and others. How do we connect them to true discipling circumstances and situations and grow them, and not just a social program in that sense, but a real evangelistic opportunity to grow disciples. One of the things is that I wanted to say is that everybody's not going to come to the church. So not just finding opportunities to minister to individuals, but how do we now plant recovery churches? We planted 6 other congregations in our community because those individuals weren't going to come to our church necessarily. And so what we do is we find individuals who want to go and continue to love and create a community around where that neglected neighbor or that neglected neighborhood is, and then put a church there that's going to reflect the neighborhood and the individuals that are there, and they'll feel much more comfortable in that environment. And not to be afraid to do that. I think that's one big area that we have done starting house churches. We started 6 real full churches that have their own buildings, but we've got so many other house churches that also meet, small groups that meet throughout the week in different places. In those communities that we serve, you plant discipleship ministries, and so you give opportunity for them to know on Tuesday nights that whatever, you can come and be ministered to discipleship. They're not going to necessarily come to church, but eventually they will either come to the church or somewhere else. And we actually help a lot of churches in our community because, as Al was saying earlier, a lot of times people, we're ministering and people don't know it's Peace Baptist. They just know it's the Kingdom of God. And so we've helped a lot of other churches in their growth in that regard. I think the other thing that I would say is that some will want to come to the church. And so the church has to do a job of making sure that who it's ministering to, it's willing to have in their congregation. Because as you go to your neglected neighbor, your neglected neighborhood, they're going to come and visit. So you've got to make sure that any of the issues that may be a barrier, that you begin to address those. Because if you've got a homeless guy or a hurting family, they've got to feel comfortable to be in that fellowship of your church. And so what kind of things do you need to do to be able to make sure that individual feels connected? You got to look at the children's ministry. You've got a children's ministry that has a whole lot of young kids in there, and now you've got hip-hop kids coming in now because you've been ministering to them in block parties and other areas. How are you going to address that? What are you going to deal with that? And I think we as a church have to have real hard conversations about those kind of issues of wanting to minister to those individuals, because the issue is not just feeding them and clothing them and taking care of them. It's about them growing in Christ. And so I think there's some real conversation just about how does this look in the context of our church? And that's not easy. That is not easy. I'm not just talking about race. I'm talking about socioeconomics. You've got an individual church that has people making $60,000, $70,000. Now you mention to people who are $20,000, $25,000 a year family household income. I don't care if you're the same color or not. It's different. It's a whole different mix. How do we begin to work that is going to be important. I think one big area is your young people in your church, your young adults. This gets their heart more than anything else. And really turning this piece of tying those individuals back and getting those young adults involved, this right here just rocks those the young adults in a big way, because they want to do something. They want to be able to make a difference and change the community. And so I would release our young adults in a big way.
Jerry, you want to address that as well?
Yeah. As a suburban church, kind of away from the city, as we begin to try to meet the needs of the city, one of the things we discovered we had to do was to have fellowship in relationship with churches that were in the city. And so we began to network with Brothers in Christ who were open to us talking and partnering with them in ministry, so that there were ministry points that we could actually refer people to and send people to. Now, we honestly have seen an ethnic diversity in our congregation over the last 4 or 5 years that I think is directly attributable to our engagement in the city. In fact, it's pretty marked that there is our congregation is beginning to ethnically reflect our city much more, and we celebrate that. And when we have, we've seen a big change, but it has required our senior pastor and myself particularly to network with other pastors around the city, particularly African American pastors, because of Richmond's ethnic makeup, and find out who of these guys have warm, tender hearts, who's ministering to a lower middle class or a lower class congregation and community. We actually have planted some churches in the city as well that are much easier for folks who are coming out of drug addiction and recovery to attend those places than to come to our great big kind of cathedral looking congregation, which is a barrier. But I do think you have to address where are you feeding these people to? Where can they be congregationalized? Where can they be discipled? And a lot of that's a kingdom-minded networking with other congregations. One other issue I want to speak to is last May we hosted a citywide rally for the foster care system. In Virginia, there are 5,000 children who are in the foster care program. There are over 1,000 of those who have all parental rights severed. They are, in essence, orphans. We don't call them orphans in the U.S. particularly. We call them foster kids. And we hosted a rally inviting churches all over the city of Richmond to come together to hear a challenge for Christian families to be opening their homes. It was called Change Who Waits. We wanted to see, instead of kids who wait in the foster care system, see if there's ever a family who's going to receive them. We would like to see Christian families waiting for children to come into the foster care system and to receive them. The state director of Human and Family Services, I think's the title, was one of the guest speakers at this rally. And he stood in front of this group of Christians from all over the city, and he said, the state can play defense in the life of these children. We can protect them from the abuse. We can remove them from these homes. We can provide some transitional housing for them. He says, you guys have to play offense in these children's lives. You're the ones who can love them, teach them a way of life that breaks the cycle of both poverty and abuse. Here's the number one official in the state of Virginia standing in front of us saying, will you please do this? Now, his other challenge, he said, there is another community that will receive these children freely, and it is the lesbian community. He said, these ladies are willing to receive these foster children into their homes. Don't go out and talk about how terrible that is unless you, as Christian families, are willing to receive them into your home.
I have so many things popping through my mind as I listen to you guys. Let me just address that I was talking to a church planter who'd working in New York City, and he was telling me that he and his wife and another couple had gone to a foster care orientation type meeting. And he said when we walked in the meeting, we were the only two couples that showed up. And we noticed that the teacher just turned and started teaching us. And so there were like hundreds in the room, but she was teaching us, talking to us. And he said, and then the more we realized it, the more we started understanding the foster care culture in that particular part of town. It was made up of those who wanted to take advantage of these children to have income from the government provided to their home so they could continue in their abusive lifestyles under the radar and not really love these children. And said it seemed like the whole culture that wanted to come to this meeting were either abusive single moms who were trying to get the money or lesbian couples. And he said to me with a tear in his eye, he said, there's a lot of things that we can do in Love Loud, but I wish we could just do away with everything else and just say we're going to fix this one and get the church to try to attack and do something about this one and see what we can do. So there are plenty of opportunities. God's going to invite you right where you are in your church, but you can't overlook this one. Yes, ma'am. Okay. You want to repeat the question and start answering it?
The question was related. There are a lot of good organizations that are non-Christian that are doing good work. How do we train our folks who get involved to truly be Christians and get to the message of Christ? One, we do personal evangelism training with our congregation regularly, and we try to do it in a way that it's a very simple way of sharing your story. It is not a formulaic way. It is, what is your testimony? What was your life before Christ? How did you come to know Christ? What's your life like after Christ? A friend of mine by the name of Dennis Nunn does a fabulous job of training every believer witness. How do you just tell your story? In the context of serving people, they will ask you why you're doing this. And it is the open opportunity to share your faith. I think another issue to address related to the question is that one of the things I did with our staff when we began to move into the community, I looked them in the face. I said, are you willing to serve alongside that you don't believe the same things they believe? Are you going to be offended when somebody who has a whole different worldview wants to be involved in the project? I said, we've just got to face that, because sometimes as Baptists, we don't want to associate with people who we don't agree with on every point. And frankly, that group gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So the issue is not, do you believe the same thing that I believe, but do you care about the same thing I care about? And frankly, when you care about the same thing, you then begin to have conversations with those folks who have a completely different worldview, who all of a sudden will look at Christianity as having some authenticity because you're doing something that really matters. And you have conversations not just with those you're ministering with, but those in the community who have a very different worldview. But frankly, they're surprised to see the Christians show up, particularly if you're not combative or arrogant with them, but you relate, you build a relationship with them, you share Jesus with them as well.
Noah, do you really?
Yeah, I think so.
You think he answered it well?
I think he did.
I think there's a lot more to be said, and I love Jerry. let me just say one thing as I hand you the mic here. It's a very tough thing, Jerry, and you really put some good things on the shelf there. I hope that you don't miss. Because there really is a point counterpoint here, and I think you can make a good argument. You can make a good argument to have a distinctively Christian thing that you're doing, and it's all you're doing, and you're serving in the name of Christ. But in other situations, they need people that are Christ-like to come into that environment and try to influence that environment with, I care about what you care about. And that's something you're going to have to deal with in your own church to know, is it a totally church-based type ministry that you're accomplishing, or is it Christians that are living in a missional mindset that are going to a place where they normally would not show up, and they're there serving because they care about something and watching their testimony turn the conversation around. So you want to address that anymore?
Yeah, I would add this other element to this other layer, is not just partnering with other individuals, but resources to be able to fund the ministries that you're doing. We started out being very afraid of doing grants or getting monies that weren't just coming from our church. And I was very adamant. I was the one who was championing that. And but I realized we were actually limiting the opportunities that were there. And the monies is money that comes from our tax dollars and all of those things. And then in 96 or 97 or so, charitable choice was passed where they could no longer discriminate against religious organizations. And it changed the landscape. And so we began to go after grants. Like I just mentioned earlier, we got $1.3 million grant there. We got through our foster care ministry a $50,000 grant for 3 years each year from my governor's office to do foster care ministry and help in those areas. And they have not put any restrictions on us sharing the gospel at all. That it is not true that, and so just assuming that you can't do it is not, at least experiment. I would say experiment, go find out. Find out, are they going to let you have you cover up the cross and not be able to share? the Christ. They do not, they have not restricted us in any way. We just cannot say to someone, because you're not a Christian, you can't come to this program. We have to, and we want it to be like that. We want it to be open to all. And so I would just encourage some of you all not to be afraid to maybe to look within your community, to take a second look, because the laws have really changed. It's not as bad. I know there's some stories out there that has been rough, but there's many more stories out there where you can use the funds. Now, just make sure you manage them well. We got this $1.3 million grant, and the government said, we are not going to give any more to churches, because every church we've given it to in the country has messed this up, and we're no longer going to give this to churches. And they were going to give it to these other groups that they talked about. And we said, please try it. We wrote the grant up, and they said, okay, we're going to do it. The government last month came in, and the federal government for 2 weeks did an audit on our entire church because we wrote the grant up wrong, number one. We tied it to our 501c3 of our church organization. So that gave them access to our whole church finances plus, you know, the actual grant itself. And so they did it. They said, oh, we got a church now. We're going to forensics on that. But our stuff was really tight. The state and the federal came in, and they said, wow, we are so impressed in what you're doing, not just financially, but what you're doing in the lives of these individuals, because we're following the kids home with their families and doing things. We are now going to open this up to other churches. We're now going to take a second look to be able to see that perhaps churches can do it. And my point is, if we're out of the game, if we don't engage, what happens is we give those dollars, we give opportunities to other ministries, to these lesbian groups and these others, to take things that God, I believe, is calling us to be able to have an impact in. And so we have to be engaged. I'm not saying you have to do it, but I think you do have to explore the opportunities in your community because the needs are there and the resources are there for you to be able to do even more than what you're doing currently.
You know, Jesus said, I have a food you know not of. Y'all just want to skip lunch and hear Tyrone tell some more stories. We're about out of time, and I'd love to just ask some more questions and get some more response from you. If you look at that card we gave you, it might be a way that you can ask a question that we can figure out a way to follow up with you. We're in the process right now of trying to not only make our website a learning opportunity, but a listening opportunity and a networking opportunity. And so we have a guy working with us under contract right now, Sam Dula. He was on staff with Dahati, and I know you were impressed with Dahati's testimony a moment ago. And so Sam is trying to help us talk to you and learn what you're doing and see what ways that we can help you. So don't be surprised if you get an email or a phone call from Sam as you add in response to this card and see what we can do to help. So if you'll take a minute to fill that out and give that to us on the way out. How do we get started? You have a comment, a question? Okay. We'll try to make sure we can share that, but you can give them a way to contact you.
Okay, yes. Tyrone Barnett is my name, Peace Baptist Church in Decatur and Tucker, Georgia. Peace Baptist Church is our church. And peacebaptistchurch.org, you can go on our website and see some of the things that we're doing. Right.
Craig Ornsby, I'm not sure if I'm getting all the letters in there right, but you can find him on the First Baptist Woodstock website, and you can make contact with him that way.
Jerry Daniel, Grove Avenue Baptist Church in Richmond, Virginia. We are groveav.net is the website.
And you can reach me just by loveloud@nam.net, or you can write agilbert@nam.net. Lorna, why don't you stand for a second? Lorna is working in the West region of the U.S., and is it official yet, or is it tomorrow? Okay, so tomorrow she'll have an official assignment to help provide some service and cooperation in the West region how we're configured now in NAM. But she's also a part of our team in a matrix relationship with that region to see what we can do to serve. Final questions? Yes, sir.
You want to see kingdom impact, and some kind of way you have a measure, a matrix for kingdom impact. What type of impact? What is the growth of the congregation? How many people in that church are engaged? At that time when I started with the church in my home with 14 people, but we probably had up until we got about 200, 100% of those people actively engaged in ministry before you start seeing the numbers coming. And I think that's some kind of way, it's some kind of measure to find out how many, not just how many are coming, but how many are going, and measure that in some kind of way, because that's a healthy church. And that will produce a strong, healthy church that can reproduce other churches. And I really think that's, you hit it right on. I think that was really the strength of our story. It took a number of years before we start seeing the numerical growth take place. But we saw right away the impact of our, those who came being engaged in the church and in the community itself. Yeah.
This afternoon at 4, our particular assignment and panel will be addressed to serving a church planter, and how a planter uses Love Loud type ministries to do church planting. And so if you want to spread that word to anybody that might need that, to come back and be a part of that discussion, we'd love to continue that part of the conversation. As we look at the ministry landscape of North America, we see the existing church and the expanding church. The existing church, maybe many of you are coming from, and our message to you is, you can get outside the walls and you can do this, and you'll be surprised. You might experience the same thing First Baptist New Orleans experienced. When they started this ministry, they called it the care effect, because they learned that when I care, God changes me, and when I care, God changes the person that I'm trying to impact. And so the effect is on both sides of the equation. Some of our dying churches would be revolutionized if they started seeing what Jesus sees in their community and started learning how to love loudly in their community. But the expanding church, first of all, we don't have to tell the next generation. They've already figured this out. But what can we do to serve them in the process of best practices and ways that even resources of people that will come help them do ministries in their cities as they try to do this? So we'll talk about that a little bit this afternoon.